Well, it's a big project, and I think the people who made it recognize that there have been a number of challenges, and they outlined a number of them at a recent meeting of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, some of which I'm sure the commission didn't know about, some I'm sure they did. A lot of it involved early days of fabrication in which welds were made in China or they were brought here and they started to fail. So they had issues there. Then they had an issue that they discovered about 2007 involving these large stranded together pieces called tendons. They're like individual pieces of steel strapped together into giant tendons. And they found that there'd been corrosion on them. They did some testing. Some people don't think that it was an adequate level of testing. And then they basically said, they're fine. There's enough duplication, or what they call duplication, redundancy, that they don't have to worry. Some people think that they do have to worry, but Caltrans has basically studied the problem and decided that that wasn't a risk over the long term, because they had enough of these strands to make up for the fact that some of them had corroded, because during this discovery, they found that water had gotten into the ducts that carry these strands before they were supposed to have grouted them up, filled them with grout to prevent water from getting in. They were exposed to the elements, and water had caused some damage to some strands. There's an open question about how much ultimate damage might have been caused, but Caltrans found that the damage they could see was not as significant as they might feel would jeopardize or require new strands to be put in or do something else. So that was a problem that they've accounted for in their minds, and other people disagree. Then we have the bolts themselves. In 2002 and 2003, Caltrans faced a question. How were they going to protect the thousands of high-strength steel bolts and rods they were going to put in the bridge? And if you galvanize high-strength steel, it's a risky enterprise. Hydrogen can get in during the galvanization process. That means dipping it in molten zinc. Or it can sneak its way in a marine environment by way of gaps in the coating that's supposed to protect. And actually, it could virtually backfire and make them more prone to failing, because the zinc that's supposed to protect them can actually, through an electrochemical reaction, drive the material that causes them to get even more brittle, and that's hydrogen, into the material. Where it's supposed to be safely outside, it can actually be transported into the steel. And when hydrogen gets into steel, it can crack and become brittle very rapidly. And what happened was, when they tightened up 96 of the rods earlier this year in March, a third of them failed within 2 weeks. So that prompted them to start looking at all the other rods, what they're being used for, because stress is a key factor. The tighter they're held in tension, the more likely that they could be susceptible to cracking. The demand is a key part of it. Then, of course, the presence of hydrogen, which they definitely have out there, both in the form of rainwater and just moisture and mist that is constant in the bay environment. And it's also salty, which can also contribute to the corrosion phenomenon. And the material that they use was deemed by industry for many years to be not acceptable for use on bridges, because it is by nature vulnerable to this phenomenon. It's too strong to begin with, and so it can't resist the attack from hydrogen. Milder steel or softer steel that's not as hard can't be used in a high-strength application, but has built-in resistance. It's essentially immune to embrittlement.
Well, it's not like it was a big surprise that this is a foggy marine environment, and that's where bridges are often made, because they're built over water. So why are they recognizing these chemical problems now, or coming to recognize these chemical problems now, when these should, it seems, be understood before they go into the process of building it?
That's a mystery that is still being unraveled. We know that Caltrans knew that certain high-strength rods and bolts weren't acceptable on the bridge for the risk of the marine environment. Then they set about using virtually identical high-strength rods on the bridge. And how they convinced themselves that the risk wasn't there is a question that isn't quite answered at this point. We know that in 2003, they acknowledged that certain high-strength rods with a certain specification shouldn't be used in a marine environment. Then they set about using another designation. It's called an A354 BD, which is a type of rod. That it was okay to use that, they decided, even though it's virtually identical to one that's banned for bridges and that they themselves didn't want to use for the risk in the marine environment. How they came to that conclusion is unclear, and why they didn't heed the risk to the marine environment that they had acknowledged with the other virtually identical material, the A490s, which, you know, materially and metallurgically, they're identical. It just so happens that they have different industry designations, and one is allowed to be galvanized and the one is not. A490s cannot be galvanized and cannot be used on bridges, even by Caltrans's own standards. And A354s, the ones they end up using, they also used A490s, they just didn't galvanize them. But the A354s that they ended up using were banned under Caltrans's rules. And they said that those were standards for standard bridges, and this is not a standard bridge. But did they really understand why their standards were in place? What was the risk? There's not really a clear record that they took into account the marine risk.
It's impressive that you can commit all these numbers and designations to memories. I'm sure that this is actually something that you haven't been looking at for all that long, but that's a lot of codes.
Yeah, it is. But parts. I mean, you have to know the basis of all this you basically have to reverse engineer their decision-making process. And that means you have to read the industry standards. You have to understand how it is that we looked at a number of industry standards. You have to buy the industry standards or get them from the industry group, the American Society for Testing and Materials. They send you the standards if you request them, but you can't get them on the internet. So one of the things is, if you read the standards, it says for these A354BD rods, you can galvanize them, but it's research has shown that if you galvanize them, and they can be susceptible to cracking and on bridges or wherever they're used if they're under a high stress.
Is that pretty clearly written? I mean, is that something you find?
It's a note on the standard. It says it's like a black box warning on a pharmaceutical product. It basically says research has shown that hot dip galvanized, which is what they did with this 354 BD rods, are susceptible to cracking from embrittlement, which is the code word for stuff that gets in contaminating during the industrial process, or stress corrosion cracking, which is what happens when you put something in a marine environment.
So is it fathomable to you why they could miss that?
Is it fathomable? It happened. I don't know why it happened. I mean, they apparently did no research on the risk of doing this material. They didn't understand that it was virtually identical to the material that they didn't allow to be galvanized. They didn't research the long and storied history of why this stuff is not allowed to be galvanized, or why galvanization is not recommended for this product. They didn't recognize that Caltrans itself in 2000 had banned using the galvanized product. Or if they did, we don't have records of how they reconciled their own general rules with this bridge. I mean, this bridge is just as vulnerable as any other bridge, whether it's a standard. What they said was that those are general standards, and this was an exception from those standards because this is not a standard application. But the rules are based on the risk, and the risk is just as high on the bridge as it is in any other bridge. So it's not, I mean, the standards had a reason, and deviating from them without taking protocols to acknowledge the risk beyond just the potential that they could become contaminated during processing. They just disregarded the potential that it could be damaged in the marine environment. And now there's a question of why these rods failed. And Caltrans's metallurgical study, which was done doesn't really decide the issue whether these were damaged by sitting in rainwater, which a number of these rods did over a number of years, or whether they were somehow contaminated during processing. But the bottom line is that the material itself was too hard to begin with and was susceptible or prone to this problem. So how it got there is almost, we still don't really know, and Caltrans doesn't know, and yet we're making decisions about the material now.
That's Jackson Vanderbecken. He's a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Do you think at this point Caltrans has been and is being forthcoming about what it's done, what it knows, and taking responsibility?
Well, they've released some material about it, and they think they've answered what questions they have been able to date. I don't think we have all the information about what they did or what they didn't do. I think we have a version of events that sort of puzzles a lot of people.
Well, that said, do you get the impression that they're being as transparent as they could as they do their own research into what's happened?
Well, I mean, I think there have been people who've been critical of that. You know, the Senator Mark DeSantis, who oversees the Senate Housing Transportation Committee, has questioned Caltrans's, has sent them a series of letters asking for more documents. There have been some documents that have been released. Is it a complete record of the documents? Based on what I know, I don't think it is. I think that there may be more documents forthcoming. We'll see. In the meantime, Caltrans has to make some decisions about whether it's going to open the bridge as scheduled over Labor Day weekend. And on July 10th, they say they should have that question answer, whether they're going to be making the deadline, whether they will have resolved a number of these issues about how they chose these rods on anchors and bolts. I don't know whether that is ever going to be satisfactorily answered.
Well, since that deadline is something that people have their eye on quite a lot, and the July 10th decision about Labor Day weekend, what are the costs and benefits versus risks on opening it then or not? I mean, obviously, from a safety standpoint, you just want to make sure, you know, they've done all due diligence, but there is also the rush to get the thing done.
Well, Steve Heminger, who's the executive director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, spoke about that at some length at their recent meeting, and he basically said that if they don't make the Labor Day opening, you know, all bets are essentially off. They don't know how long it might be. It could be well into next year before they find a suitable time frame to open the bridge while traffic is low. They're not going to do it during the holiday season. So they seem to be hard set on making this deadline if they can, although they say that safety is a critical issue and they won't open the bridge unless it's safe. How that's measured, and there's two questions. What they do now, I think as they go forward, they could theoretically open the bridge and start replacing some of the harder copies of these anchors and rods and bolts because they are by nature more prone to fail than the less hard. They come in a spectrum of hardness, and it's based on a sliding scale. So they might, according to their own expert, who wasn't their expert at the time they made this decision, he wants or has thought of saying that any of these rods and bolts are above a certain hardness measurement should just be removed. And recently, however, he has modified that stance to just basically say that, well, let's study the problem and know a little bit more about what the threshold might be and then go from there. But that still could happen well after the bridge is open. The only thing that's really delaying the bridge opening is whether they can put together this fix for the 32 rods that failed of the first 96 that they installed back in 2008 that were tightened in March of this year. 32 failed. So they're throwing out all those rods, not literally because they're keeping them in many of them in place, but they're not using them to anchor this seismic shear key, which is supposed to resist seismic forces. And it's bolted in at a high level of tension to keep it from moving. And so the bridge operates as a unit and it doesn't literally fall off its supports. So that has to be, they have engineered a solution involving basically strapping down what they call a saddle, which it looks a lot like, you know, kind of like a football arm pad that they sit on top of what the bolts are and they strap it down. Kind of looks like like a bit like a parachute, the way they strap the cables on the side of the bridge and anchor them at high stress. And so what they're doing when they haven't finished.
It's like a brace.
It's like a brace. It's essentially, it's a supplement to the rods, which are basically being, you know, discounted as being worthless at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've reduced the tension on those rods anyway, for whatever reason. So they basically have given up on them. And so now they have to figure this method out. And once they get it in place, the contractor will be able to tell them whether to be able to get it done. If they can't get it done by Labor Day, they're not going to get the bridge done by Labor Day. So that's really the governing factor, whether the contractor tells them that they can meet the schedule. And then, of course, that nothing goes wrong. And that's not been the pattern on this bridge. Things go wrong. So between now and Labor Day, virtually everything will have to go right for Caltrans for them to make that date.
That's Jackson Vanderbecken. He's a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. So I'd like to get some context on what's going on with the Bay Bridge. There are a lot of bridges around the Bay Area, and there's a lot of huge projects around the world. I'm wondering, are the problems that are coming up with this one, and the cost overruns for that matter, are these unique to the situation, or are these different kind of obstacles that are often overcome when you're dealing with a major infrastructure project?
Well, I think it's a little of both. This is a unique situation in that this is a unique bridge. It's a kind of a self-anchored suspension span of its type has not been built before to withstand the earthquake forces that are envisioned, the most probable quake that could occur in a 1,500-year cycle. So it's a big demand, and there's a lot of leaps that were taken in making this bridge.
How big, incidentally, would that quake be in a 1,500-year cycle?
Well, I think it's going to be, you know, over close to 8 or above. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the exact seismic forces, you know, how they work. I mean, there's so many different variables. You know, seismic forces can work. For example, in the Loma Prieta quake, the bridge, the old bridge, survived because it was relatively short in duration. But it created a large impact in the Bay Area nonetheless. It's just that that bridge did not completely fail, in part because the shaking forces that translated over the long distance were relatively short. Mm-hmm. And so whereas this bridge, they have to model all sorts of forces to come up with, you know, the worst combination thereof, the most accelerated forces across a number of spectrums, is sort of like the worst of the worst. And they're using a probabilistic model instead of just like thinking of like what's the worst earthquake that anyone can envision. They work up a model that says this is the worst earthquake that is probable over a 1,500-year period. So, and that's the modeling that went into this. And that's the standard this bridge was built to withstand and stay operational. As Caltrans officials point out, most bridges, even if they're made earthquake resistant, are just meant to survive the quake, not fall down. This is a bridge that's made to be operational within, you know, 24 or 48 hours. It takes a lot of engineering to weigh. They have a lot of things that have to be calculated, and they have to make things that are made to break, literally. They're sacrificial, so to speak, in this bridge to handle the forces. The tower, for example, has these connectors that are not made so much that they would ultimately not fail. They're basically made to fail and hold the tower together as a unit. So they've done a lot of things that they understand, you know, would end up having to be replaced or modified. These bolts, however, a number of the rods and bolts cannot be replaced. They're either at the bottom of the tower, and they can't lift the tower up to get them out. Otherwise, they've only removed one, and they had to cut it up in 6-foot segments to do it. Then there's smaller bolts that are actually holding together seismic stabilization bearings. They're big triangular, like teeter-totter-like things that work to distribute the forces in a quake. They're bolted together, and they can't take them apart. They're sandwiched between the road deck and the concrete pillar below that sits atop the column. And so they take the forces, and if those failed, you know, it's unclear whether the, those things would still be able to work. They can't even inspect those. There's 96 of them. They have no, all they have is pre-inspection, pre-installation data about them. They can't look at them. They can't take them apart, and they can't remedy that situation. So, and they just turn out to be hard enough that they, according to Caltrans's own experts, they he would have advocated that they be removed. Now they're going to have to arguably live with them because they can't take that material out.
That's Jackson Vanderbecken from the San Francisco Chronicle. He's a reporter reporting on the Bay Bridge construction. As we look across the Bay from the Bay Bridge, you see the Golden Gate Bridge, which has seemed to be essentially indestructible and doesn't have evident seismic improvements going on right now. Why does that design have success, which was made, 75 years ago, as compared with the different failures that are going on here? What's the difference between these constructions? Because it seems like that one, you know, looking back, we weren't there then. But
first of all, it has been retrofitted. And it's been in the process of being retrofitted for seismic forces for a number of years. So it's not perfect. But it's also a different kind of bridge. It's not a self-anchored suspension span. It's a standard suspension span with two very large towers that the seismic forces handle that differently. And the suspension spans in general are more quake resistant because they move and they can move more successfully and basically swing. This bridge, being the design of the Bay Bridge, involves one large 525-foot tower that's anchored as best they can into the rock below, okay? And yet it is, it holds itself in position by its virtual weight. It's called a self-anchored span. It holds down the cables that are literally run strapped to the top of the tower and back down. So it's got a novel design, and a lot of the quake forces are focused on the tower. And so that's where things are allowed to shift around. It's basically allowed to sway with the tower being the robust anchor that can sort of with the drive any swaying forces downwards to the bay rock below. So it works on a different principle than a standard suspension span, which basically allows everything to just kind of sway. And so it can handle quakes, although they did retrofit the Golden Gate Bridge.
But obviously it was more minor retrofits than building a whole new bridge to replace the eastern span.
And they decided that the Bay Bridge, the existing Bay Bridge, would basically sway apart. It was too flexible. It couldn't be made so it would stand. Now, this is in dispute, but Caltrans opted over several years to the first decision was to replace it. And they used a standard, basically a Skyway-type bridge, not very dramatic at all.
It would be kind of like in the Florida Keys, where you just have big, long road with
what
nothing above your heads.
What they call a box girder bridge, which is basically just, a span with nothing to look at.
It's a Skyway. Carquinez Bridge, right?
Well, there's stuff to look at the Carquinez Bridge. But, I mean, above, there's, I mean, this would just basically be, you know, an invisible bridge that's just sort of there, okay? Like a giant overpass that goes all the way across to the Yerba Buena.
Like a four-mile-long overpass.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, a number of political folks, Jerry Brown and Willie Brown at the time, weren't happy with that. They thought that they deserved something more dramatic and iconic.
Something that would look cool on a Golden State Warriors shirt.
Well, I don't think they thought of it that far ahead. But nonetheless, they wanted a dramatic design. They wanted a signature design. And there was a competition, and in the late 1990s, it was set upon to build this particular design. There have been critics of it, and by 2002, however, it had been accepted, and they ultimately only got one bidder to build it, and they stalled the project and rebid it, and they ended up with the same situation. So ultimately, it was built. But like I said, it pushed the envelope in a lot of directions. I mean, there's welds on this bridge. They had to develop new welding technology. There's these rods, which, you know, whether Caltrans knew it or not, they were taking a leap using these rods in a structural application on a bridge. And so, you know, now, you know, it seems kind of odd, but Caltrans is having to grapple with something, having surmounted many engineering challenges to make this bridge. You know, the joke is that the bolts are kind of the dumb end of this operation. You know, it doesn't, I mean, this was not a particularly, I mean, if anybody had consulted a single industry standard manual, contacted the Federal Highway Administration, read a DOT study that dates to 1991, they would have all seen that this is no way to build a bridge with high-strength material that's been galvanized. Galvanizing puts high-strength steel at greater risk of failing than just using high-strength steel with no galvanization. So galvanization adds to the risk of failing in the environment. Ironically, even though it makes things look rust-free, it has an unwanted side effect, which is that it can betray its mission by allowing hydrogen to get in.
That's Jackson Vanderbecken. He's a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. So when did they start the process of working on the new Eastern Span? In what year was that?
Well, they started preliminary stuff back in 2002. And they've been working on it off and on. I mean, they you know, it came in phases, because what they had to do is build basically a bridge, to build a bridge, to hold up the span, which was not actually anchored from above until last year. So what happened was they built the bridge, and they built what they call false work, which is essentially, you know, an erector set style bridge that then they plunked everything in position and put the skyway in. Then they attached or tensioned the self-anchored span and basically hung it off that as of late last year. So now it's functioning as a bridge. Before, it was basically two bridges.
And they started to think about making a new Eastern Span back in 89, I guess, after the
failure. The original, there was a study done, several studies, and thought about whether they should just retrofit the existing span or whether they should build a new one. And that's where we get this interesting thing where the original span was going to just be this skyway, and it was going to cost $1 billion. And then they argued against, well, retrofitting would cost $1 billion. So it was an equivalent cost. So then it became, well, geez, we can get a whole new bridge for the same cost as retrofitting the old one. Then what came along was the signature span design, which obviously everybody knows inflated costs and time to completion. And also there were other issues, the shadow that the bridge cast on, you know, historic military structures and residences. And, you know, there are any number of, you know, pitfalls, and that caused a year delay when they had to redesign the course of it to eliminate the shadow problem. I mean, it's been a troubled few years that this bridge has had to, they surpassed all these major design challenges to be dogged by bolts.
Well, how late is it now? When was it originally supposed to reopen when they decided they're going to build a new bridge?
Well, you know, it's arguably at least 5 to 7 years late. You
and
know,
how over on. Budget is it then?
Well, it depends on what. It's at least several $1 billion over budget from what was originally envisioned to be its cost, and now it's $6.4 billion.
So maybe 5 years late, $5 billion over budget, maybe.
Well, I don't think it's roughly. $5 billion over budget. I think it was going to be at least $3 billion even in envision. So it's probably run double what its original cost estimates were over time. You have to account for the fact that there was a snafu in 2005 in which they stopped all work on it and had a committee decide whether it would be better to go back to the skyway design or some other thing. So there was a lot of unforeseeable delays in this process, that the design itself, the question of whether to do the signature span got reassessed at that time after Governor Schwarzenegger asked some questions. And they ultimately went back to doing it again, but that was a time frame. There was a lot of chaos going on. They started a bridge, and then they stopped it, and then they started it. And then, you know, then timetables became critical, and lots of decisions got made. There are literally, you know, as many decisions on this bridge as there are parts on it. There are over 1 million bolts and rods on it. So, you know, those all have to be spec'd, bought, purchased. I mean, you know, the logistics of this, which, you know, obviously, especially with Caltrans, which is normally quite rigorous in its quality control, we've seen that in the heat of the moment, there have been apparent lapses in that. So, you know, you just don't know how it is that things happened when the dust got settled here. I mean, some things apparently had no quality control at all. Other things got, you know, quality control, but then they made exceptions to the problems they found. So you don't know. You're only getting a small number of decisions being made in the heat of the moment. You don't really know. That's one of the things that I think is concerning to people, is if given the kind of decision problem quality that we've encountered on just this critical but lesser decision, some people have asked, well, what does that say about all the decisions we don't know that have been made? And clearly, one critical decision that's been made is that a number of these parts simply cannot be replaced. Now, they say that that's not abnormal, but if you want a bridge that's going to be survivable and you're going to have failed parts and you can't replace them, that's a question that, you know, I mean, obviously they're counted on redundancy to solve.
Well, now that you have immersed yourself in studying this bridge construction, what is your overall quick impression of this process of building the thing?
I don't think that there's one standard that was applied throughout. I think that there were a lot of different standards depending on who was in charge of various projects and processes. I think big engineers were in charge of big problems. And, other problems were delegated. But in that process, things fell through the cracks, at least related to these bolts and rods. The decision-making there has not been particularly well contemplated. I mean, there's no evidence they did a study on the risks of using this material, that they even knew about all the industry warnings, even their own warnings. I mean, it's almost like, you know, one day, this actually happened. The structural committee that oversaw the bridge of design contacted the designer and said, what are we going to do about these rods? How are we going to protect them against the environment? And the bridge designer didn't know the answer. And then Dyson, the Painesville, Ohio company that ultimately provided many of these bolts and rods, we offered up our services. Hey, we do this all the time. And, oh, by the way, we did it on the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. Okay, so it turned out that 2001, they had used the rods or bolts on the 2001 retrofit of the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, but they weren't tightened. They were just what they call snug tight. Well, that's not a comparable application to running something at 70% of its capacity to fail. I mean, it's like, you know, basically saying I can drive a race car because I can ride a motorcycle, or I can drive a race car because I can ride a tricycle. And then they only had 2 years experience at that time in 2003 when they were pondering the successful 150-year expected lifespan for this bridge. They had 2 years of snug tightened bolts on the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. That was used as a standard to decide whether these could be safely used at a totally different application under much higher stress and with limited quality control. I mean, you know, how did that decision get made? It seems like they did. And then they called out to the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge and go, hey, you have any problem with this? Nah. And that's it. That was it. There was a question about whether these rods could become brittle during processing. They tried to eliminate that. But that's only half the coin. You know, the other coin is that they could get exposed to hydrogen in the environment. And they knew that that was a risk, but they didn't really account for it. And they still haven't accounted for how they really grasped that risk or why they didn't think it was a risk when they had acknowledged the risk when they tasked this solution in the first place, because they knew that a second class of rods that are virtually identical to these ones should not be used in the marine environment if they're galvanized. So you've got this situation in which you have an absurd result. You basically say, if not A, then B, but if A equals B, then you can't have A or B, okay? Well, they decided, if not A, what about B? And then they looked at B as like a totally different animal, as if it had nothing to do with A, when A and B are virtually identical metallurgically, and that's the only thing that we're talking about here, the metallurgical properties of these two things. In fact, these high-strength rods that they used are thicker than the band ones that can't be galvanized. And experts say that that thickness puts them at greater risk, not lesser risk. And we're talking about a structural application, which means high capacity material taken to its highest capacity. And it's not like snug tight. No, we're talking like something that's 70% of its estimated failure capacity. It's going to fail at 100%, or it's rated to fail at 100% or so. So it's got a rated capacity. It's not the same thing as its absolute capacity. But anyway, the bottom line was that they were putting this stuff under high stress.
Well, I get the impression that this is probably not the end of what we're going to be hearing about what's going on with
No, I don't think so. I think that there's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of questions and not a lot of answers at this point. I think Caltrans just wants to get on with it and stop dealing with how this decision got made and start dealing with how they're going to fix what they can fix now and maybe fix the harder copies of these rods, the more vulnerable ones to the marine environment over time. They're all too hard. Virtually all of them, with a few notable exceptions, are too hard to be allowed on a bridge based on U.S. Recommendations, based on the DOT's recommendations that date back to 1991. So now we're bargaining with what to do with the balance of this stuff that should never have gotten there. Had anyone checked, they would never have accepted this. Now we're picking and choosing what we can accept from unacceptable material. We're having to compromise, and they haven't even opened the bridge.